First, there came a lessening of demand for repentance. There came to be more of an emphasis upon outward rituals rather than genuine repentance and faith in Jesus Christ. This was a natural thing for people to. Man doesn't mind more little outward physical exercise. If he can accomplish a relationship with God with this, this is easier than humility and submission to Jesus Christ. And so this was a natural departure. And associated with it, or perhaps a resulting of it, came the baptismal regeneration era. People came to the place that they accepted the rite of baptism as salvation itself. And they felt that it did. They eventually reached the place that they accepted this as being necessary for the salvation of the individual, and eventually as being all that was necessary for the salvation of the individual. And so this followed soon in the departures from the truth. Then came a thing that showed up early, even in the churches in Asia, in Paul's writing the revelation and delivering the message to the seven churches in Asia. The clergy rule, where the preacher became the governor of the church rather than the leader of the church. And the next natural thing here, when the rulership fell into the hands of the clergy, then eventually there had to be a top bulb somewhere. So there came the area bishops. Some pastor in a metropolitan area who had to help to organize a number of churches in the suburban areas, he came to be looked upon as the bishop for the whole area. And Eusebius says, some of the other historians support him, that the time came when the pastor who had the largest church in the metropolitan area would attend the council, and all of these pastors of the smaller congregations in his area supported him. He led the way, and they backed him. When it came time for a vote on an issue in one of these councils, whatever the leading clergyman in their area did, the rest of them all supported. And so the bishop, the area bishop, came into being. It started seemingly as an innocent thing, but look what it has developed into in the Roman Catholic system now. And once the bishops or the pastors, the clergy, began to be those who decided what was orthodox and what was heretical, the next thing was infant baptism entering into the picture. They decided that since baptism was a part of salvation and necessary to salvation, that it should not be denied to infants. They should baptize them too. And so these are the step by step innovations that crept into the early congregations, led them astray, and eventually brought the divisions that came and eventually produced the monstrosity that known as the Roman Catholic hierarchy, and the other groups known by several names which you have begun to discuss that oppose this departure. Now, as we noticed last night, about the first of these came in the second century under the leadership of a man known as Modinus, and they were known as the Modinists. This group came in a separation from the churches that had taken in many of these innovations in the North African area and in Numidia, and they came to be known as the Modinists. Then, about 251 A.D., a man by the name of Novatian in Rome left the church in Rome over this and built up a following, and they were known as the Novatians. Then in the 4th century came the next man to separate from these churches over these areas, and his name was Donatus, and his followers were known as the Donatists. Right there we'll peg it down for just a little while, because in the 4th century a very important thing happened in the history of the church that changed the whole pattern of the Christian world. This was the period of time when Constantine was emperor of the Roman Empire, claimed to have been saved. He made a profession of Christianity and was baptized. There are two points of view. Some think that he really was saved, but was in error in his concept of Christianity. Others think it was a shrewd political move on Constantine's part, that his empire was coming apart from the east, from the west, and he saw an opportunity to become a Christian and to hold his empire together. Now, you can ask him if he gets to heaven, and you do too, what the truth of the matter is, but some things we do know that resulted from this. There was a council held in Nicaea location, now known as Constantinople. This was a resort palace for the Roman emperor, and it was held in 325 A.D. It was called by Constantine the emperor, and his ambitions appeared to be good. There were divisions among the churches over these issues all over the empire, and his idea was to bring all of these preachers together in one great council and decide once and for all what was orthodox, and then throw the weight of the Roman Empire behind it and move along. Well, this sounded good, you know. There's just a few things wrong with it, and they're pretty badly wrong. Eusebius, in his writing, says that when Constantine called this council together, that these preachers came from all over the empire, from North Africa, from Armenia, from back in Rome and that area, over in Asia. They all came together, and the way Eusebius expresses the thing, he says some 3 or 4 days before the council set, all of these brethren together let off a lot of steam up and down the corridors of the buildings discussing these issues among themselves. Well, that sounds normal, doesn't it? You can imagine if you get as much division as there was going on, and you get this many preachers together in this wide area with nothing to do but wait for the emperor to get ready for the meeting, boy, they're going to settle a lot of issues up and down the corridors. And so this went on for some 3 or 4 days, and then the day came for the council. And the brethren all gathered in the great chamber, and Constantine, emperor of Rome, came in with his royal robes, and very humbly said, "Now, brethren, we're glad you're here for such a noble purpose. Who will you have to moderate this meeting?" Guess who got elected? Yeah, you're right. After all, who paid the bill to get them there, and who was taking care of them while they were there, and who was going to support the decisions of this council? So Constantine was elected as moderator of the council. Now, fortunately, several of the doctrinal decisions that they made were scriptural. The virgin birth and inspiration of the scriptures, and a few things, salvation by grace, though the interpretation of that probably would not hold. But some of these things, these were good, because they were right according to scripture. But
Here was where the terrible error came in. First of all, no meeting of clergymen has any authority to determine what is orthodox and what is not orthodox for the churches of Jesus Christ. This is an issue that they decide upon the searching of the Scriptures for themselves. And nobody can hand down a decree and say, this is orthodoxy, you abide by it. So the council was out of order on this score. The second thing that was wrong was once the council had decided what orthodoxy was, the emperor threw the weight of the Roman Empire behind it. And all of those clergymen that went along with it and their churches had the support of the empire. Well, they said, well, this sounds like a wonderful thing. They'd been persecuted by it here before. Yes, it sounded like a wonderful thing. But it was the greatest tragedy that ever befell the churches of Jesus Christ. Because let me show you something. Once you decide officially by a state what is orthodoxy, you have also decided that everybody that doesn't agree with it is a heretic. And once you throw the support of the state behind what has been decided as orthodoxy, you throw the support of the state behind the effort to destroy all opposition. What happened at the Council of Nicaea in 325 was purely and simply this: the marriage of the church to the state. And the state was going to enforce orthodoxy by the sword. Now the emperor said, now brethren, we've had a great meeting, and we've determined the matters of orthodoxy. Of course, there were a few Baptists walked out on that meeting. But this has all been decided, and some of you brethren have just been getting along and haven't been paid what you're entitled to. And the empire's going to underwrite. We're going to subsidize your salaries and pay you what you ought to have to live on. Oh, hooray for the emperor. This sounded great, John. And some of you churches have not had decent baptistries, and we're going to build baptistries for you. And in those days, when they built a baptistry, it was a complete building within itself, separate from the church. And the baptistries that the empire built for some of those churches were bigger and nicer than many of the churches that you and I meet in today. And this sounded great. But what about those who did not believe the error that had been set in motion? They came under the wrath of the Roman Empire and were branded as heretics, and consequently, since the state is now supporting this movement, those who disagreed became civil criminals and were prosecuted under civil law. And any church that didn't receive the baptisms administered by these churches that the Roman Empire is supporting were civil criminals because they refused state-approved baptisms, and they were prosecuted as civil criminals if they dared to rebaptize anyone that had been baptized by the authority of a state church. This was the foundation that was laid for the Roman Catholic system and has held ever since, a state church. It wasn't 3 centuries after this was done until a Roman emperor appointed a pope as the world head of the Roman Catholic Church with the authority of the Empire of Rome behind his decision. And he alone determined what was right, what the churches would do, who would be persecuted, and who would be blessed. And the Roman Catholic system was on its way early in the 7th century. Now, it was in this 4th century when this the marriage of the church and state came about, that the men Donatists down in North Africa rebelled against this idea and the innovations that had come in, and he would not have any part of it. And they demanded that any person who came to the churches where he and his followers held forth must be rebaptized. They would not recognize baptisms approved by churches under the authority of the state of Rome. Consequently, the empire turned its wrath, and the state churches now turned their wrath upon Donatus and his movement. He had many followers down in Africa. He had thousands of followers. Many of them were slain and tortured and persecuted. By whom? By the state churches that are now basking in the blessing of the empire of Rome, because they didn't agree with them. They were not following the scriptures. And they tried to hold the New Testament pattern, and for it, they felt the wrath of the empire and of the monster, Roman Catholic monster, that was rapidly building up. Now, right here, we need to go back east again. I hope you have kept our geographical sequence in mind. Down in North Africa and in Numidia, in Rome, these areas is where the separations have taken place from those who are departing from the faith and accepting the state church. But let's go back to Armenia. There's some question in the minds of historians just who really started a movement known as the Paulicians and just how they came by their name. One thing is certain, that they began virtually in the first century, and they carried on in that area for a long time, but they did not come into prominence until about the 7th century, 6th and 7th centuries, when another man by the name of Constantine, no relation to the emperor, whatever, was saved, and he seemed to be the leadership that these churches needed. And they became strong, and they became aggressive. And so a movement of churches who would not accept the state church that now has grown strong, known as the Paulicians, began to be dominant on the scene. This is spelled, if you want to continue the list, Paulicians, Paulicians. These Paulicians began to move westward. As they came through the Numidia area, they were received by the Montanists. In fact, the Montanists, what was left of them, were virtually absorbed by the Paulicians. The Novatians, as they continued to move westward, were virtually absorbed by the Paulicians. The Donatists fell in line and in fellowship with the Paulicians. And as they moved into Europe, virtually every dissenting group who refused the state church received fellowship and became identified with the Paulician movement. Now, it's ridiculous to think that the Paulicians were heretics if they are received by the Montanists, the Novatians, the Donatists, the Albigenses, and many others who came along later. In this period of time, for what's known as the Dark Ages, from around the 7th century into the 16th century, some 700 or 800 years, the Roman Catholic Church became strong enough that it controlled the state. No longer did the state control the church, But the state church controlled the state. And kings dared not rebel against the Pope and his edicts out of Rome. Spain became a Roman Catholic church state. Italy became a Roman Catholic church state. And France became much the same thing. And they've spread throughout Europe and dominated the scene and controlled the British Isles. A king, hear me now, a king could not marry without the consent of the Pope in those days. And the Pope usually saw to it that a king on a fringe area somewhere that he thought might be pulling away from the church, he saw to it that the only marriage that got his blessing would be for that king to marry a queen from some strong Catholic country somewhere to keep the tie together. Tell you where the Episcopalians came from when we get through with this thing. Good divorce case, I'll tell you. This situation naturally brought tremendous pressure upon the dissenting groups known as that we've been talking about here. And in Europe, there came to be many groups at this time. Some of them were limited to very small areas. Others more extensive. The Albigenses, for instance, was the name that these people were known by generally in France. And when they crossed the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain, then they picked up other names, sometimes known as Cathari. It's a word that simply means pure. That's a wonderful nickname. People say, call you Cathari. You're such pure people, you know. And that's the name by which they went. There was a man named Arnold that led the fight against the persecutions of Rome and the heresies that were being introduced, and his followers were known as the Arnoldists. There was a group known as the Bogomites. There was a man known as Peter de Bruce, and his followers were known as the Petrobrusians. There was another one, a man known as Peter Waldo, and incidentally, if you have or you want to pay the price to get a copy of the history of the churches in the valleys of the Piedmont, there is in that history a declaration of faith which the Waldensians accepted that was written in 1120 A.D. Now you keep in mind this for 500 years before Calvin or Luther were ever born. That declaration of faith was written, and Peter Waldo helped to write that confession of faith. Now, some think that this is where the Waldenses got their name from, Peter Waldo. Since you have to write this name, they're known as the Waldenses. But really, the word Waldenses simply means, term by which the same group was known, meaning the same thing, was the Valdoi, or the Valley Dwellers. They got this name because the persecutions of the Roman Catholic Church, especially as it came to be personified in the House of Savoy, drove all these groups, which we believe to be the predecessors of Baptists, underground. Many of them were driven into the valleys of the Alps Mountains in an area known as Piedmont. There is an area over in North Carolina that is known as the Piedmont area. The Piedmont Airlines, you may have seen advertised. I know you've seen them advertised out here, not I've ridden them, is headquartered in this area. It got its name because the area is very similar to an area in the Alps Mountains where the Waldenses hid out from their persecutors during this period of time when they were trying to destroy all those who opposed the Church of Rome. Now, these people, being valley dwellers, were known as the Valdoi or the Waldenses, and virtually all of these groups, including the Paulicians, came to be known commonly in this Alps Mountain area as the Waldenses. We have the record of what they believed. When the back of the persecution was finally broken, the King of England sent his emissary down into these valleys to find out what these people believed, how they lived, and who they really were. The official report of what he found and sent back to the King of England has been preserved in the history I mentioned a moment ago, known as the Ecclesiastical History of the Valleys of the Piedmont. It's a history of the Waldensian churches in that area. It's an unbiased thing. It isn't a religious history. It's a legal report to the King of England. But to give the King of England an honest legal report, they give the declarations of faith of these people, what they believe, how they lived, and what they stood for. And you have that history has been preserved, as have a few more, and is published in Texarkana by the Baptist Sunday School Committee of the American Baptist Association, and is available today. It's a little difficult reading because it's actually photographically reproduced, and it's written in the Old English style. But once you whip a letter or two of the Old English reading, you can come right along with it. But the history is there, and it's still in publication today. Now, what we have found is this, that eventually the persecutions of the Church of Rome have driven all the dissenting groups together virtually under a common name into a common reservoir for a common defense in the Alps Mountains. And it seemed at the time that there was nobody left. They were all known as Anabaptists. The Donatists were known as Anabaptists. There is a history written by Littell, I believe, known as the Reformers and Their Stepchildren, and of course we're the stepchildren, in which he states that the faith of the Baptists of England was the same as the Donatist of the 4th century, and that they were there all the way through, and that they were indeed Anabaptists.